This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Let me talk to you for a minute about one of my favorite products ever. A product that I bought myself long before we had any relationship with this company on this podcast. I'm talking about the Peloton, of course. I love my Peloton, and you will too, especially if you have a busy schedule and you're working all day and you're running around for others. There are up to 14 new classes added every single day. There are over 8,000 on demand. Personally, I am approaching 400 rides. I absolutely love the product. Love it. And you will too. The Peloton bike comes with a 22-inch HD touchscreen. It's beautiful. There is a near silent belt drive, so it's super quiet. And it's got a compact 2x4 footprint, so you can fit this thing into your living room or even in your office. Mine is in my office at home, and it fits beautifully. Bring the cycling studio to you with Peloton's cutting-edge indoor cycling bike. There are no more excuses. Peloton is offering you a limited-time offer. Go to onepeloton.com and enter the code ROME at checkout. Get $100 off accessories with your Peloton bike purchase. Get a game-changing workout at home anytime you want. That's onepeloton.com and use the code ROME and get started. I'm telling you, I love this product. You'll love yours too.
You know, they incorporated the Europeans into the British and Irish side. Then it became, I'm sorry, that's my room service there. It became a good deal more important, I think.
Hey, David, I don't want you to go hungry. If you want to pick that up, you should.
Yeah, no, don't worry about it. I've lost a little weight, but I could lose a little more.
Welcome to the Jim Rome Podcast. This is episode 55, and my guest is David Faraday. David Faraday is more than just a world-class golf broadcaster. He is a former tour pro who won 10 times around the world. He was a member of the 1991 European Ryder Cup team. He is a New York Times best-selling author. He is the host of the hit TV series Faraday, and he has an amazing one-man show. It's called Faraday Off Tour. David Faraday is one of the most beloved people in all of sports media and somebody I've known for a long time, and the conversation that we had is amazing. We talked about golf, we talked about life, we talked about his battle with sobriety and the tragic loss of his beloved son, Shay. This is a conversation that I will always cherish and a conversation that I am very proud to share. Episode 55 with David Faraday starts right now. My man, with your TV show, your work with NBC, David, your stand-up show, your speaking gigs, your work with Troops First, and more, you are a very, very busy man. David, it is so good to have you on this podcast. How are things? How is your life right now?
Oh, it's great, Jimmy. I'm delighted to be here and to be talking to you again. You know, it's been too long.
David, it has been a long time, so it's good to have you here. I've got so much I want to talk to you about, but I want to start with your live show. You have a live show called Faraday Off Tour. It's a stand-up show. David, this is not an easy thing to do. How did this come to be, and what's it like doing it?
Well, it's a lot of fun doing it. Jim, I'm terrified before I get on stage. It's a two-hour show, and, you know, just the prospect of, you know, trying to hold an audience and trying to make them laugh for 2 hours is sort of daunting. But once the bell rings, I've been fine so far. I've done more than 100 shows across the country. And the way that it started, really, was I was doing a speaking engagement in Canada. And there's a promoter called Brad Jones up there that promotes Jeff Dunham and Larry the Cable Guy and a few others, or some country artists, that was in the audience. And he asked me, you know, if I'd ever thought about doing it, you know, in front of an audience. You know, and that's what I thought I was doing. But, you know, he said, no, in a theater. So I hadn't. And we did a couple to start off with in Canada, one in Edmonton and one in Calgary. And this was in November and December of about 4 years ago. So it was minus 20, and I'm not sure that people had anything else to do except come and watch me. But there were 12 or 1,400 of them showed up, and it's been just a blast from there on.
Now, David, you, in all sincerity, you are one of the funniest, most engaging, talented people I've ever come across. Exactly, and I understand where people have a fear of public speaking and getting up in front of others, but you are so engaging. What is it that's terrifying to you about this?
Well, I'm frightened, Jim, and I think most performers are to a certain extent, but it's the thought that this might be the night that I freeze up or forget what I was going to say, or you just never know, and you have to be on your toes, all the time and thinking, and in my personal life and whatever, I'm not really great at that. At times, but then again, it doesn't really matter because, you've got plenty of time to stumble and, think about it. But when you're on stage and it's just you and a microphone and a spotlight and there are, 12 or 1,500 people there, that's an entirely different prospect. So it's just daunting. And like I said, it sort of scares the living daylights out of me until... I get on stage and get a hold of the audience and feel like, I'm in charge of them. And that's the huge buzz, I think, when it comes to, entertaining people. You see it with comedians or with actors, all the time. There's a high that comes with it that, I've had a lot of highs in my life and a lot of lows. And this is one that really satisfies me and makes me feel better about myself.
Good for you, David. So when is the next show, and how do people get tickets for the shows?
Well, if you go to FahertyOffTour.com, you can get you'll get all the details for it. FahertyOffTour.com. And the next show, I think, is I've got three in Ohio coming up. I've got Cincinnati and, now you're asking me. I don't really pay much attention. I just show up and do this. But I've got three in Ohio. Then I'm doing one in Myrtle Beach for Kelly Tillman, who used to work for the Golf Channel. That's a charity deal, that I really care about a lot. I was in Kansas City last night and did a kind of a private show for Children's Mercy Hospital there. And those are the ones that are really satisfying.
Good for you, David. We have a lot of listeners in the state of Ohio, so I know they're going to come out and they're going to support you. This is just one of many things you're doing right now. But if we were to go way back to where and how it all started, when you were growing up, what did you want to do? What did you want to be?
I really only had two options as a child. I was a hopelessly attention deficit child and didn't really know. 45 years ago, nobody had a clue what the hell, ADD was. But, and it's only when I had my own sons tested here in the United States that I understood that, it was like looking in a mirror and I thought, well, that's what was wrong with me. I couldn't pay attention to things that didn't interest me. I loved music and I loved English. And those were the two things that I excelled at, and everything else, I just sucked. I couldn't pass an exam to save my life. So I actually wanted to be an opera singer. But in my late teens, I left school at 17 years old, after hearing myself sing. And I thought, well, that's the last thing the world needs is another mediocre Irish tenor hammered, clutching the bar and butchering Danny Boy. And the only other thing that I was interested in was golf. And I had a 5 handicap at 17 years old, and when I look back on it now, it was a miracle that I ever got good enough to have any kind of a professional career. But it's the second career that has really astonished me, and the fact that I've been in the United States, there's nowhere else in the world that this could happen to anybody. It's been amazing for me, and I love it.
David, your second career really has been something. It has been amazing, and I really am eager to talk to you about that. But talk for a few moments about your first career. Fact of the matter is, you did turn pro at 17. You played for the European squad in the Ryder Cup. So let me start right there. What was it like to play in the Ryder Cup? And was there anything that anybody could have said to have prepared you for what was coming?
No, I don't think there was anything that anybody could have said. And oddly enough, I'm actually in Kiowa Island right now. For a speaking engagement, which was the site of the 91 Ryder Cup, the only Ryder Cup that I played in. It was the first Ryder Cup that really captured the attention of the American public. It was the one where it came down to the final match on the last day, on the last green, where Bernhard Langer and Hale Irwin, Bernhard missed that 5 or 6 footer. And if he'd made it, then the cup would have come back with, this is when I was a European. Now I'm an American, and it sort of pisses off me to my old European colleagues that I support the U.S. Ryder Cup team. But, I pledge allegiance to the flag and anybody who fights underneath it. So, I love to see the Americans do well. And that was one where, Bernard missed the putt. And the cup stayed in the United States. And even though I was a part of a losing team, it was a huge high point in my career. And when I think of just a couple of weeks ago in Paris, covering the Ryder Cup there, I've been to pretty much every one since 91. And I don't think I've been in an atmosphere anything like there was in Paris. And again, we didn't. I'm on the other side now, and again, we didn't win that event. But it was just amazing to be there and be in that crowd and be in that atmosphere once again. It's one of the great events in all of sports.
Hey, what are you doing this week? What are you doing this weekend? Are you looking to have a night out? Everybody loves a night out, whether it's seeing your favorite band in person or being there in the crowd to cheer on your favorite team. With Vivid Seats, you can attend the concert, a show, or sporting event of your choice at an amazing price. Vivid Seats is where you want to go. It's the top source for tickets for all the live events that you want to go to. You can sort by price, or you can look for seats in the section and row of your choice. And to make things even better, Vivid Seats is giving you an exclusive promo code if you're a new customer, and you can receive 10% off your first ticket order and save even more money. Just go to the App Store or Google Play and download the Vivid Seats app. First-time customers can use the promo code ROME for 10% off your first Vivid Seats order. Every purchase is backed by a 100% buyer guarantee. From the biggest concerts and games to the hottest theater and more, Vivid Seats has it all. Download the app, enter the promo code ROME, get your 10% off. Vivid Seats is where I go when I want my tickets. Make a memory that lasts a lifetime. Let Vivid Seats help you get to your favorite live event. This is a tremendous company, and I'm proud to partner with them, Vivid Seats. Go back to Kiowa in 1991, and you were a big part of that. You beat Payne Stewart, who was the U.S. Open champion at that time, 2-1. What do you remember about that day?
Yeah, that was a day that probably the best round of golf, Jim, that I ever played. I was 4 up with 4 to play, and Payne... didn't play particularly well on that day, but I played out of my mind. But I lost 2 holes in a row. I lost 15 and I lost 16. And I went into a full, flat-out panic, code brown. And the crowd control had broken up in between 16 green and 17 tee. And there were just, hordes of people slapping people on the back and chanting and singing and yelling and waving their signs. And there was a lady marshal that got in front of me. I knew if I lost 17, I was more than likely going to end up losing the last 4 holes. It was just one of those atmospheres and one of those moments. And I was panicking. And this marshal got in front of me. And she poked me in the chest with her quiet please sign and said, "Where do you think you're going?" Like I was a heavily disguised spectator.
Right.
And I was about to go batshit crazy. With this, when an arm came around my neck and Payne put his cheek just right on mine, and I can still smell the red man from the plug that he had in his mouth, and he had that idiot choir boy grin, and he said, "Man, I'd love you to keep this asshole right here, but he's playing against me."
Wow.
And he swept me up onto the 17th tee in his arm, and that's who he was, Jim. anybody else on that side probably would have let me stew and let me lose my temper and probably let me lose the 17th as well. But that's not who Payne was. You know, he understood the Ryder Cup and what it was about and the sportsmanship. You know, I managed to, I think, half the 17th hole with him and win that match. And there's a hole in the PGA Tour where he used to be that'll never be filled. I miss him. And especially when I'm in this area in the low country here, I think about him all the time.
David, such a great story. Such a great, great story. And then you mentioned the atmosphere in Paris. You know, and you're an American citizen right now, and you admitted that you were rooting for the Americans, but the same thing happened to them that often happens almost every single time when they go over there. They get rolled yet again. Everybody's got a theory on this, but why does history repeat itself, in your opinion? Why can't the Americans win over there?
Okay. Well, when I was, you know, I played 18 years in Europe, and we had only one major, Jim. It was the Open Championship, and people were judged. The players were judged not just by the amount of tournaments they'd won, but by what their Ryder Cup looked like, what their Ryder Cup record was. And in this country, people don't really think about it. It started to turn a little bit. You know, what kind of a Ryder Cup player were you? Never mind the amount of majors that you won. And I mean, people are trying to, you know, get a grasp, I think, of, you know, just how significant the event is. I mean, it's one of the great events in all of sports. And it deserves to be taken a little more seriously, I think, on this side of the Atlantic. And I think that would translate to the players' attitude towards it. You know, they're starting to understand, you know, what it means to have a good Ryder Cup record. And I think the pendulum has swung towards the middle now, you know, and it'll go backwards and forwards. There was a long time there were, well, there was forever when the British and Irish and then the Europeans, you know, we lost pretty much all of the time. And the event was in danger of becoming irrelevant. And then when Ballesteros and Tony Jacklin, you know, in the late 70s, you know, they incorporated the Europeans into the British and Irish side, that it became, I'm sorry, that's my room service there. It became a good deal more important, I think.
Hey, David, David, I don't want you to go hungry. If you want to pick that up, you should.
Yeah. No, don't worry about it. I'm, you know, I've lost a little weight, but I could lose a little more.
Whatever you want. Whatever you want.
Yeah. But I think that's the reason, Jim, is that it doesn't matter as much to the Europeans, to the Americans, as it does to the Europeans. I think it's getting there, and it's really very close. I mean, it's not like they don't try. It's not like they don't care. But it just means more to the Europeans.
I can see that, certainly. David, I could talk to you at great length about your first career. I think your first career is fascinating. But in terms of your second career, you know, back in the day, you would come on and you and I would talk about your friendship and relationship with Gary McCord. When you first bumped into McCord, he asked you if you had ever done TV before, and you said no. He asked you if you wanted to, and you said, nah, I don't know, maybe not. But you did go on with him. What was that first appearance on TV like? How did that feel to you?
Yeah, that was at the international tournament in Castle Pines, and Frank Turkinian, the legendary producer, was producing at the time for CBS, and McCord had actually asked him, "Look, I've got this buddy of mine who's Irish that I think, you know, would be okay at this. You know, is it okay if he comes up in the tower and spends 30 minutes with me? You know, like calling and answering questions?" And Frank said, "Damn it, no, we don't want that Irish prick up there. God, you know, because Frank knew me." And, you know, McCord said, you know, he gave me the thumbs up, and he said, yeah, he said it was okay.
Right.
So I got up there unbeknownst, you know, to me and unbeknownst to Frank as well. And I did about an hour with McCord at that point, and Frank kind of softened. But that was like maybe 2 or 3 years before, you know, I got the opportunity to say yes to a contract. You know, so I really do owe it, you know, to Gary. When I look back and think about that, it was a big move on his part, you know, to trust me, and to sort of go against Frank's wishes.
David, he knew, though. I mean, Gary knew, or Gary had a sense, but then you did the show with him, and then he knew when he said, look, this is going to be your next thing. So after that, you're sitting, as the story goes, you're sitting in a hotel bar. A couple of CBS producers approach you. What did you think that they wanted?
Oh, damn. Yeah, I remember it. I was in the middle of a horrifying divorce at the time, and my career had gone. My playing career was looking, details were sketchy on that one. I was drinking very heavily and taking, you know, maybe 15 or 20 Vicodin a day. I'd really become an addict. And, my life, I was undiagnosed at the time, but, you know, severely depressed. And two gentlemen came across the bar at the Hilton in Fairlawn in Akron. I'd qualified for the World Series for some reason. I think I'd won a tournament in some communist country. I don't know where the hell it was. One of them stuck his hand out, Lance Bauer, and he said, we're from CBS. And I thought, shit, 60 minutes. Yeah, this will be some fearless expose on drugs in sport or alcoholism in golf or something like that. And, of course, it turned out not to be. They were looking for a replacement or somebody that could fill in, you know, for Ben Wright, who had been fired because of the aftermath of the the remarks he made about the LPGA tour and the ladies. You know, if I recall correctly, he said, well, you know, women don't play golf as well as men because their boobs get in the way. And
that's what he said.
That's what he said, yeah. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, well, fair enough. No, they can't be a help. And as it turns out, you know, they wanted somebody to work, you know, on the ground. And initially I said, I was 36 years old, Jim, and I thought I had some golf left in me. And I said that, and then they told me how much they were going to pay me. I said, do you want to buy a set of clubs? Because that was it for me. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that I played the second round. I don't remember.
Oh. Give me a minute so I can talk to you about one of our partners. Dickies. Dickies is the number one brand in performance workwear, and Dickies knows work is more than just what you do, it's who you are. And just like professional athletes, your work is judged by how you perform on that job. This is why Dickies Flex Work Pants and shirts are engineered to give you superior mobility, advanced protection, and enhanced durability. And Dickies Flex is backed with Dickies unconditional satisfaction guarantee, so you know that the Flex series is made to work as hard as you work. Dickies Flex, engineered to move, engineered to last. Learn more at dickies.com. Once again, go to dickies.com. You and I in years past had talked about the battle with alcohol. How fierce of a battle was that? You once called yourself the Tiger Woods of drinking. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, it was and it still is a battle, Jim. I lost my son a year ago, a little over a year ago, and, full disclosure, I've really struggled since then. I'm sober today, and I hope I will be tomorrow. That's the way that it is. But it's an ongoing battle, and something that I don't expect, you know, to. It never gets better. It just gets older, and it's one of those things where I know I'm never going to recover from it. But I'm fortunate enough to have such great friends and people that love me and look after me, that would throw themselves under the bus rather than see me, go down that road again, I've always been really grateful for that. Tom Watson, of course, being the lead character in that particular play.
In fact, in terms of that, David, Tom Watson, why don't you share that story, if you don't mind? You were working an exhibition match on Prince Edward Island between Tom Watson and Jack Nicklaus, and Watson told you something that you would later say changed your life. What did Tom tell you?
It did. I was in the very depths of my depression at the time, and drinking probably a bottle and a half, two bottles of whiskey a day, and taking God knows how many painkillers. And it was Tom against Jack, and I was doing I was the on-course commentator for an exhibition match between the two of them. I'd interviewed Jack already, and Jack and Barbara were sitting behind me. And Tom and Hillary were there, and I got Tom in front of the camera. And all I could think of was, I wanted to get back to my room to the bottle of pills and the bottle of whiskey that I had there. And I asked Tom the first question, and he looked at me kind of funny. And he said, "You're not well, are you?" And he put his hand over the lens. And I didn't know what to say, Jim. I looked at him, I said, "No, I'm not." I said, "How do you know?" And he said, "I can see it in your eyes." And I said, "What do you see?" And he said, "I see my reflection." And I didn't know that Tom had a problem, and very few people did at that time. He's been a lot more open with it, since. And at that point, Tom said to me, he said, "You need to come with me." And I said, "To where?" He said, "To Kansas City." And I said, "Well, you need two kayaks and a float plane to get to Toronto. From here, how the hell am I going to get to Kansas City?" And I hear this voice behind me, "Yeah, you need to go with him. You look like shit." I'm being heckled by Jack Nicklaus and coaxed on by Tom Watson.
Wow.
Two of the most important people in my life because of that. And Jack flew me and Tom to West Palm Beach the following day on his G5. And I went with Tom to Kansas City and spent two or three days there, went to his meeting, and he went. He found me a meeting in Dallas, and I went there, and I was sober for almost 10 years. I fell off the wagon and I had a very hard time, for about a year or so, went to rehab, came out, and was doing really well until my son died. And that hit me, as you can imagine, extremely hard. And I've struggled since then, but I've been good, and I feel well. I feel more than capable of doing my job. I've been good for a few months now, and I'm hoping that it'll stay that way.
David, I am so sorry for your loss. You mentioned your son was Shay, and I wonder if we can just talk for just one moment or so about Shay.
Sure.
What was Shay like?
He was he was like me, people liked him, and he was funny, but he was kind of he struggled with life in general, and I struggled with trying to, it's very difficult when you have a child that ends up, and this is something that I would say to anybody who's listening: please research your family history. If you have children, look into it and see if these problems are there, because you're infinitely more likely pass this on to your child if there is that history in your family. And for me to say to him, "No, you mustn't do this and you mustn't do that," when he looks at me and says, "Well, you did all of those things and look how successful you are," that was the hardest part of all. It wasn't the hardest part. The hardest part was withdrawing from the situation, because any expert will tell you that when you have a child who has addiction problems, that is depressed or whatever, you have to let them hit bottom, and you have to withdraw from the situation. I was enabling him by giving him money and believing him, because every liar or every addict is a liar. I've been a liar myself. I understand the problem and the way that it works, and that's the hardest thing of all, knowing, that your child is suffering, but not being able, to be there for them, because you have to let them hit bottom and then step in and say, "Hey, it's all right. This is this is the way that it works, and your life can be better.
David Shea was 29 when he passed, and you know, if you saw some of you in him, I'm sure that he was wonderful. I'm sure he was so funny and so likable. And I would imagine, I mean, I can't imagine, but I would imagine that you never, ever get over something like that. You somehow hope just to get past it and just go day by day. You heard from so many people after Shea passed. What did that mean to you?
It meant the world to me. President Clinton picked up the phone and called me. I had messages from President Trump and President Bush and, you know, people all over the world when they found out about it. And it was a tremendous comfort to me, you know, that people would think about me at such a time.
You bet. David, I'd like to ask you about Rory McIlroy for a minute, and I appreciate your thoughts on Shea. Rory's your guy. You go way, way back with Rory. In fact, how far back do you go with Rory?
Well, you know, I watched him grow up, you know, he was another one, you know, that reached out to me, you know, this youngster that I've admired. I've loved him for so long, and I'm so proud of him that, you know, he's from this little place, you know, that I come from. And he's been a tremendous support to me and so kind.
You know, David, he reached out to you, but you reached out to him after his Sunday meltdown at the Masters in 2011. And I'm not sure you'll admit to this, but he says you were instrumental in helping him deal with that, that you went and you saw him right after you got off the air. What was that night like, and what did you tell him in the aftermath of that?
Well, after he unraveled on the back nine, was it 2011?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it was. I was so worried, Jim, you know, it might affect him for the rest of his career. The kind of, you know, leading by four shots going into the second nine at Augusta. And, you know, to see what happened to him was tremendously worrying to me. So I went round to the house that he was, where he was staying. And he had a couple of kids there, you know, his friends from school, in Northern Ireland, and they were kicking a football around in the backyard of this house they were staying at, and they came in, and we had, you know, a Coke, and I was expecting him to have a few drinks, to be honest with you, and I said, are you going to be all right? And he said to me, he said, if that's the worst day I ever have, he said, I'll be lucky. And I looked at him, I thought, you know, there's a kid that's going to be special. And, you know, the attitude that he had towards it, as grown up as he was, as heartbroken as he was, the way that he took it, I knew that he was going to be all right after that. And, of course, he goes out and wins the next major championship by 8 shots. He's a special person, and I don't think that anyone makes the game look more beautiful than he does when he plays well. Like I said, you know, I'm incredibly proud of him, and I love him very much.
Listen up, because this is really key. No matter how big or small your team is, Ferguson has a winning game plan for pro contractors. With thousands of plumbing repair parts, knowledgeable associates, and the largest national footprint in the game, when the pressure is on, count on Ferguson. Your TV show is still doing extremely well. I want to ask you about Patrick Reed, because you had him on your show. You've spent some time with him. You know him pretty well. He's a pretty polarizing guy. Between the win at the Masters and the loss at the Ryder Cup, he's seen the highs and lows of this season. What do you make of Patrick as a golfer and Patrick the personality on tour?
Well, I mean, obviously he's a fantastic player. He's a Masters champion. And like you say, you know, he's kind of a polarizing figure. And every now and then you get one of those in golf. You know, we've seen them before, whether it's, you know, like a Scott Hoke or Mark Calcavecchia was like that to a certain extent, you know, where, you know, you like people or you don't like them, or and players like them or they don't like them, whatever. But, I mean, I like Patrick Reed. I do. And I think he's kind of, you know, he's forging his own path out there. He may not have the multitudes of friends, you know, that other people have, but he's single-minded. He's a wonderful player, and you know, I had him on my show, and he's had some hitches, in his personal life, you know, with his wife and you know some of the things that have happened, you know, to her and you know his family life and all that. And I think he's done very well, you know, because of that. You know, his college career, there was some, I don't know, you know, how to put it, even, you know, whether or not, you know, he was, there were kind of cheating allegations, as I recall, you know, but he's shown nothing but courage, you know, since he's been out on the PGA Tour, and he's a young man that I like very much.
David, I want to say I've done this a long, long time, so I know how challenging this can be. Challenging to get people to open up, challenging for people to share, you know, the what they're really thinking. You do a wonderful interview, and people are really open and engaging in opening up and speaking to you. How are you able to get them to do so?
You know, I think I ask questions, Jimmy, from a position of weakness. It's not that, and I have guests. I don't have victims. That would be for Piers Morgan or you know, for somebody else, you know, where you want. I mean, I had President Clinton on. I didn't ask him any Monica Lewinsky questions. Holy crap. You know, we spent $42 million trying to find out the answer to a question I could have told you for $8 in 5 minutes, you know?
Right.
You know, so people know me and they know, you know, my flaws and where I've come from. And if I ask them a question, you know, that might be, you know, embarrassing or whatever, and I try not to do that, to be honest, you know, they know it's not coming from a mean-spirited place or whatever. You know, I'm interested in who they are, you know, because I like them for a start. You know, I don't have people on my show that I don't like. I'm very lucky when it comes to that. You know, I'm able to pick and choose. Among the people, some people call up and say, I'd like to be on, you know, or I'll make a phone call. I've just had John McEnroe on, who I've tried, and that'll be next season. And I've got Fred Couples cornered, finally. Freddie's very slippery.
God, isn't that something, yeah. Freddie?
You know, he's going to be doing an interview with me on in November. You know, so I've been extremely lucky, you know, in the fact that I've been able to have people on that I'm genuinely fond of, and I've had the opportunity to spend time with them over the last 20 years. You know, so I think that's probably why.
McEnroe is spectacular, and David, to your point.
He's wonderful.
David, to your point about Freddie, again, I've done this a long time. It's hard not to gush. When you talk to Fred Couples, Fred Couples is one of the most amazing personalities and people in that it's almost impossible even to describe why he's so cool. He's just the coolest guy, right? He's just got crazy, crazy it. It's hard not to gush over the guy and turn in your man card.
Yeah. He's so laid back, he can hardly see over his pelvis.
David, listen, really quickly. Like I always say, we don't know any of these guys. We just, how could we? We don't really know. You know Tiger Woods. I know this much about him. He's smart. He's really, really smart. But is Tiger Woods funny? Is he funny? And if so, give me an example. I'm looking for that in him.
Well, he is funny. And it's kind of evil as well. And it's really unfortunate, you know, that he's not able to be the person that I saw grow up on the golf course, you know, because we kind of beat that out of him, following him from his courtesy car to the locker room to the putting green to the practice tee to the golf course and then in reverse all the way back, you know, and in his private life as well. I would love to have him on my show, but to be honest with you, you know, I haven't actually, I've never asked him. Because you know, I don't want the sort of pat answers, the kind of I don't want them to have the force field up, you know, I really need them to be vulnerable and to. It's not like I'm going to ask him, you know, questions about the fire hydrant or you know any of that crap, but you know, I'd like to be able to show people who the kid that I watched. You know, grow up, and, you know, we're walking along the fairway and he would say, you know, under the bill of his cap so he couldn't be lip-read, he'd say, hey, Ferdy, what? He'd say, what do you call a black guy flying an airplane? I would say, I don't know. He'd say, a pilot, you fucking racist.
man.
You know, and that's the kid that I know, and the one that I want on the show, that we haven't been able to see. And he's getting closer, Jimmy. You know, you can tell. I think it was not this President's Cup last year or a couple of years, but maybe the one before where he was assistant captain. It really made a huge difference in his life, where he felt he was able to be of service to the younger players and whatever. I think it softened him and made him feel more of a part of the professional golf community, to the extent that, you know, he's been moving in that direction for the last 2 or 3 years. And I think we see it in the post-round interviews and in his demeanor on the golf course and how, just how, you know, how grateful he was to win again. And for me, as a broadcaster, you know, you try to be impartial, and you can't root for anybody. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, if you weren't rooting for Tiger Woods at the Tour Championship, really, after all that he's been through and the roller coaster that his life has been, you know, there's something wrong. It was a wonderful thing to see, and the game is so much better with him in it.
It was really something to see, David. That was absolutely something. David, leave us with this. I know that on Faraday Off Tour, you get this quite a bit, but I maybe you can answer it one more time, because I think people listening would love to hear this. Everybody, and it might be tired to you, but everybody wants to know your dream foursome. For those who have not heard this, can you share this with our listeners here? What's your dream foursome?
Well, my dream foursome, and I'm going to pick four, so it'll be a five-some. But the only reason, you know, that I'm picking four is I can't play anymore. I haven't played golf, and a lot of people don't realize it, for 11 years. I got run over riding my bicycle. I got run over by a truck, you know, pulling a trailer full of lawn equipment, got me with both axles, and kind of crushed me all the way down the left side, where my left arm is crippled, and I can't close my left hand. You know, if I were to pick four people to play in a foursome, one would be Jack, because he's one of the very few of the greats, you know, that I never played with. One would be Annika Sorenstam. She's been a great friend of mine, you know, Hall of Famer. I introduced her at the Hall of Fame, which is a huge privilege. I would play with Arnold. I played with him 3 times in my career, and I remember every shot that he hit. I have no recollection of how I played, but I remember Arnold, and it was, you knew you were in the presence of greatness, just not just as a player, as a person, you know, being with him, and I would play one more time with my son.
David, I cannot tell you how much this conversation means to me. I can't tell you how much this conversation means to people listening to it. I cannot tell you how much I admire you, how much I respect you. I want to make sure everybody listening knows that your show is going to return, and it could be coming close to them. Go to FaradayOffTour.com, FaradayOffTour.com. David, you are absolutely the best. I am so glad that we got caught up, and I did not mean to keep you this long, but I could talk to you for the rest of the day. David, it is so great to hear from you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jimmy. You're a great friend.
David, you are a great friend, and I'm proud to say so. David, thank you very much. Building professionals, you know I shout out to you virtually every single day, and the reason for that, I feel really strongly about this. Check it. If you're a contractor, a builder, or a remodeler, Lumber Liquidators Pro Plus is the only partner you will ever need for all of your flooring needs. I say that because of their special pro-only pricing and their dedicated support. LL Pro Plus will help you get your flooring jobs done quickly and profitably. Maybe you're worried about selection and availability. You should not be, because Lumber Liquidators has over 150 million, with an M, million square feet of flooring available, with over 100,000 square feet in stock in most stores. And they stock professional-grade adhesives, underlayment, molding, tools, fasteners, and grout, so you get exactly what you need when you have to have it. If you're too busy to pick up your flooring, that's also not a problem. The LL Pro Plus team's got you covered. They'll deliver it right to your job. And with LL Pro Plus, you can even get a business line of credit. Put the LL Pro Plus flooring experts on your team right now. Visit your local Lumber Liquidators store or go to lumberliquidators.com/prosales today. lumberliquidators.com/prosales. It's a truly amazing conversation with David Faraday. I couldn't respect, appreciate, or admire him any more than I do for sharing his story with us. And I know many of you feel the same way and, in fact, would like to reach out to him. You should do so. I would encourage it. You can find David on Twitter at FerretWit. That's at FerretWit, FeHertwit. Make sure you do that. I'm sure he'll appreciate it as much as we appreciate him. In the meantime, I'm going to leave my voicemail machine alone for this episode, but we will hit play on that next week. So if that's something you're looking forward to, make sure you get subscribed so next week's episode and every episode thereafter gets to your listening device automatically. It will find you. You don't need to look for it. I appreciate your support and time as always, and I'll catch you right back here next Wednesday. See you then.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.